ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
19 years ago, Vicki McCauley hugged her husband, Andrew, goodbye. Andrew was setting off in a sea kayak with the aim of being the first person to paddle from Australia across the 1,600 kilometres of treacherous Tasman Sea to New Zealand. They hoped it would take Andrew about 30 days to reach Milford Sound, and Vicki, along with their three-year-old son, Finn, would be there to welcome him. But that January day in 2007 was the last time that Vicki ever saw her husband and that Finn ever saw his dad. In the years since, Vicki has built a good life for herself. She lives in the Blue Mountains, where she teaches yoga, and she's raised Finn to be an adventurous young man, like his dad was. Hi, Vicki.
Hi, Sarah. That brings tears to my eyes just listening to you.
Do you remember the first time that you set eyes on Andrew, Vicki?
I do, and it was quite amazing because I was working at a fitness centre in Bathurst, the town where I grew up in New South Wales, and I was at the reception desk and two young men came down the stairs towards reception. One was a shorter, stocky guy with amazingly huge calves and another was this gorgeous, tall guy. And they came to reception and I looked into this man, the tall guy's eyes, and then there was this spark of electricity and the other guy, who I later learned was named Arthur and became a very close friend, he said that he was thrown across the room from the bolt of electricity that sparked between us, and that was our beginning of a beautiful, wonderful, everlasting relationship.
And you call him Ant, is that right?
Yeah. You know, Australians have this funny habit of reducing people to a single syllable. So Andrew became Ant, which was a little confusing because my dad then thought, oh, is his name Anthony? I said, no, no, it's just, I don't know, Ant just...
He's Ant, but he's tall, and he's Andrew. Yeah, it's very Australian. So where did the two of you go on your first date after this lightning bolt of electricity across the gym?
Well, he actually invited me on a cave-in trip, and he was going to be in Sydney, and he said, meet me in Oberon. And I didn't actually have a car at that stage, but he said, oh, that's all right, you can use my car because I'll be in Sydney with other friends. So I was working at the gym and got home late and looked down the driveway and thought, oh, there's a car there. Oh, it's red, must be a good car. And then when I woke up early the next morning, I looked at the car and thought, oh, not so good in the daylight. And I went to open the door and it practically fell off in my hands, and then the car was so filthy, full of junk, and I thought, who is this guy who has a car this filthy and this, you know, it's just like, is it going to even get me to Oberon? And then I tried to start it and it didn't start, and I tried again and tried. Eventually it started and I chugged my way down the street and eventually got to Oberon, and then I saw this tall, lanky young guy leaning against the wall of the bakery there. I thought, oh, phew, I found him. And then that was the start of a really wonderfully adventurous life.
How passionate was Andrew about mountains and mountaineering when you first met him?
He was working towards an expedition to climb Amida Blam in the Himalayas when I met him, so that's what he was doing at the gym, training for that. And it was all-consuming for him. And he used to have this habit of finding a job, working at that job, but spending most of the time on the job searching for his next expedition. So that's, you know, I guess a good part of his work day was actually working on his expeditions. And then he'd quit the job so that he could go on the expedition and he'd come back and get another job, and this tended to be a habit with him.
One day you got a call when Andrew was out climbing close to home with a friend. What had happened?
Andrew and I had spent quite a number of weekends down in Bungonia. He was putting up a new route in Bungonia Gorge, and I was down there nearly every weekend with him. But on this particular occasion, I had a uni assignment that was overdue, so I had to stay home on the weekend and do that. And while he was climbing with his climbing partner, Vera Wong, who's was at the time one of Australia's most experienced climbers and female alpine climbers. When he was climbing, one of the pieces of gear pulled loose and he fell and smashed his patella and suffered shock, and he had to stay down in the gorge that night and was airlifted the next day. And that was almost the end of his climbing career. I say almost because we did go on one more climbing expedition to Pakistan after that. But I think he realised on that trip in Pakistan, a couple of things happened that made him realise that his knee wasn't really going to support that challenging mountaineering environment anymore. And plus they had a pretty scary incident which almost lost the lives of the three climbers.
How did he first get introduced to sea kayaking?
I guess I should take the blame for that, because after, when he was rehabilitating from his climbing accident, I'd done a little bit of sea kayaking before, and also I do a lot of swimming. I'm a strong swimmer. And I just thought kayaking would be something that would involve upper body strength, but not, you know, his leg could have a bit of a rest. And so we went down to the Spit and hired some kayaks and had a great paddle, and I took great delight in being able to paddle faster than him. I had to stop and wait for him, because usually it was the other way around. When we were in the mountains or on the cliffs, I'd have to be always chasing after him. He's waiting for me. So I took great delight in turning the tables there. However, he took a great interest in kayaking and then soon started pouring his passions into that, because he started looking at the potential of kayaking trips extending, not so much, certainly not paddling in the harbour or not even paddling up the coast, because, you know, there's safety there, you can always pull into shore. But because he has this incredible adventurous spirit, he then was always looking for ways to extend whatever activity he was pursuing. So what can I do in a kayak? Where can I go? Look at a map. I had the stupidity of giving him an atlas one year for a birthday present. And so he'd get the atlas out and start looking, and I thought, well, that's always a little bit of a dangerous thing, because what is he planning with that atlas? And then Bass Strait was an immediate attraction to him, but that had been done many times. Lots of kayakers paddle the east coast of Bass Strait. You island hop, there's several islands. So I think the longest stretch at a time is maybe 30 to 40 kilometres. So he did that, and that was all great. And then he thought, well, I don't know how many people have paddled the west coast, only a few. There's a couple of long 100-kilometre stretches there. You go to King Island and then from King Island to the mainland. So he did that and thought, well, that was pretty achievable. So how about going directly across the middle? No one, to his knowledge, had paddled across the middle of Bass Strait directly with no islands to stop at. So he did that. It was over 24 hours, and he did have some interesting times of hallucinating from lack of sleep. He did, in fact, fall asleep at the wheel and capsize. And then he corrected his kayak, and that sort of woke him up, and then he kept going. And then when he made it to shore, his legs were a bit wobbly, but he thought, wow, you know, that was achievable. So what else? And he got the atlas out and thought, oh, Gulf of Carpentaria. No one, to my knowledge, has paddled across there. So he paddled from Divecon Point to Nullumboy. That took him 7 days in a kayak with no landfall. So he's just stuck in the kayak for that long and living in the kayak. When he, after 7 days, made landfall in Nullumboy, he realised that, oh, well, that was achievable. I made it, but I've got to devise a better system if I want to do anything more than that. And he did incidentally arrive at Nullumboy with a fever and with massive salt sores from that exposure to the salt.
And so I'm thinking back to you, Vicky, who just says, let's go down to Manly and hire a couple of kayaks, and yes, you get to be stronger and better. And then the next thing you know is, you know, kayaking,
yeah,
straight through to,
yeah, that's
Tasmania,
right,
or across,
yeah,
the Gulf of Carpentaria.
Yeah, it was just from a simple, oh, let's go kayaking, and then look what happened.
When Andrew proposed to you, in fact, what was his first plan for an engagement ring?
Lovely neighbours, Shane and Lynn, lived around the corner from us, had just imported these plans for it to make a a hard-chined plywood, marine ply sea kayak. And so Andrew thought, oh, well, let's get the patterns of them, the plans, and we'll make sea kayaks as well. And that sea kayak can be your engagement present. So there I thought, well, that's pretty cool. I get a kayak that I have to make myself instead of the ring. But luckily my beautiful mother-in-law-to-be, she told Andrew that that wasn't good enough, so he had to go ring shopping.
And did you get the kayak as well?
I did get the kayak as well.
It's a win-win.
Yes. Yeah.
And what did you do for your honeymoon?
We went to Tasmania and did various paddles around Tasmania and a bit of walking in between. And on Christmas Day, we were paddling up from Fortescue Bay to Freycinet, Fortescue Bay, interestingly, being the place where Andrew departed for his Tasman crossing. And we were on Shooten Island, just a little island south of Freycinet. And we're eating our Christmas cake that Marzi, that's Andrew's mum, had cooked for us. And we're eating that and he's looking east longingly at this massive stretch of open ocean. And I could see the glint in his eye. And he said, yep, I reckon that's achievable. And so my heart did this sort of little, well, it stopped really momentarily. Okay. So knowing that he'd progressively increased his distances and his tolerance to longer open crossings, the next leap from the 7-day Gulf crossing was to attempt the Tasman, which had been attempted before but had never been successfully paddled.
Your son Finlay was born in 2003. Did having a child make Andrew rethink at all this big plan to paddle across the Tasman Sea?
I don't really think that having a child, as much as Andrew was the most incredibly loving and devoted husband and father, he was so driven and so passionate. Passionate for his family, but also passionate for adventure. And I think that he just felt that it was something that was achievable. And it was so innate in his nature that it's such a tough question because I really need him here to answer that one.
What about for you, Vicky? Did having a baby or make you more reluctant to support Andrew's adventures?
It certainly made me more risk-averse in that I didn't feel the need or the desire to go on big expeditions with him anymore or to challenge myself because I was now responsible for this little person, this little life. And anyone that gives birth to a baby, it just becomes all-consuming and that is such a beautiful, amazing, unconditional love. And whereas I had this beautiful, had and still have this beautiful, amazing, unconditional love for my husband, the love for a baby is different. And where, as I said, I was then less inclined to go on big adventures and I had that responsibility of our child, I felt that I wasn't really in a position to ask Andrew not to go because it was so ingrained in his very being, in every cell in his body, this desire to explore and to push boundaries, push his potential.
As you say, Andrew was so delighted to be a dad and devoted to this little human. How did he try to maximise his time at home with you and Finn while also keeping up his training on the kayak? What did that mean practically?
Well, he started commuting to work via kayak instead of driving.
You live at the Blue Mountains. How is that possible?
Well, he'd have to drive down to Parramatta and then he'd put his kayak in there and he'd paddle in. He was working at Coca-Cola in the city. So he'd paddle in to the Manor Wharf steps next to the Opera House and just carry his boat over his shoulder up the concourse there and put his kayak down in the car park, have a shower, go to work, get back, change again and hop back in his kayak and paddle home. So that was a really efficient way to train. And then on the weekends, we'd do some family kayaking and Finn would sit in the hatch in the back and we'd all three of us paddle down the river or go on other exciting adventures. We always, from when Finn was a little baby, we were out in the bush or in the kayaks doing mini adventures, but obviously not anything life-threatening with a little baby.
This stretch of water between Australia and New Zealand, particularly the southern part from Tasmania across, had never been paddled before. What makes it so treacherous? Why is it such a dangerous body of water?
Well, it's below the 40th parallel. It's more into the Southern Ocean. So the conditions are much more unstable. If he had have travelled further north from, say, even the central coast in New South Wales, across the weather conditions would have been much more stable, but then it's a slightly longer trip. However, there's the weather conditions are likely to cause doldrums where there's no wind, so there's no support with wind or currents to get you across quickly. And also, I just think there was much more appeal in going at a more southerly latitude where it was, you know, the weather, the conditions were going to be more unpredictable, but that really is what energised and inspired and fired Andrew.
Who did he find, Vicky, to help prepare, you know, mentally and physically in a sense of what those conditions would be like as the journey got closer? Who was on his team?
Well, he had a great support team. He had all his wonderful family that were a huge support and continued to be a huge support for Finn and I. He asked Paul Hewitson to build a boat suited for that expedition. Paul was a huge, huge support. He was a little bit reluctant, I think, initially to get on board, but then after spending quite a lot of time with Andrew, and he'd known Andrew for many years, and he did in fact build another kayak for Andrew to paddle down the Antarctic Peninsula. So he'd already done that for him and knew of Andrew's dedication and meticulous planning. So he chose to come on board and he was a tremendous support. We also enlisted Jonathan Boger, a French yachtsman who acted as the meteorologist for the trip, and he also did a lot of psychology work with Andrew. He'd have meetings with him to prepare him for the conditions that he may face, because Jonathan had crossed the Tasman many times in his yacht, and it's a whole different ball game being in a kayak. Jonathan was quite integral to the psychological preparation and also during the trip. The psychology of having a daily weather report really helped, so that Andrew would know what was coming weather-wise. His brother Mike, his gorgeous brother, was the media liaison, so he did a lot of work with media that became a huge job as Andrew was in the middle of the expedition, because more and more interest was being generated.
Did any of his colleagues from the mountaineering world, adventuring world, kind of caution him about undertaking this expedition?
He absolutely knew it was dangerous and knew that this was sort of like his Everest. It was a massive undertaking, and he was cognizant to the dangers, of course. And at times, you know, he did struggle a lot, I think, with his ultimate decision to do this trip. You know, he devised it and thought that it was achievable, even though it had been attempted. Those attempts that were made, this was his words, weren't really a real attempt. They hadn't put enough effort into planning, and he was very meticulous in his planning. But during that preparation phase, he had so many people, and also people that I wouldn't have expected, to discourage him. His climbing partner for years when he was in the mountains and on mountaineering trips, she said to him, "No, you're crazy. Why are you doing this? You're a father now. You've got a little boy." I was actually surprised by that, because I thought that she would understand that drive and that determination and that deep need to do this. You know, it's so hard to if that's the essence of your being, how do you turn away from that? And then that was something that I then had to deal with. It was a huge, huge dilemma for me, because I knew that this was a deep passion of Andrew's, and he had this incredible drive, which is really what drew me to him in the first place, because he was so exciting and so driven and so passionate about life and living life to the fullest and extending his boundaries and really going to the limits of physical and psychological endurance. And that's certainly what this trip was going to provide for him. This would really stretch him beyond, I think, beyond his limits. But it was in some ways disappointing that people I thought that would be on board with it were quite discouraging. And when I did make that choice that I had to support him because he was going to do it, it was a bit of a, damned if I do, damned if I don't, because if I said, no, I'm your wife and I'm the mother of your child and I do not want you to do this trip because we should be your focus, I thought, well, you know, do I have the right to tell him that? Because, you know, he's an individual, I'm an individual, we all have our individual choices. We're a family, but we're still individuals. And I didn't feel that there was my right to expunge that passion and that, you know, that sheer exhilaration that he creates from not only the expedition itself, but the process of working towards the expedition. There's so much involved. Mm. And in fact, he left his work, he resigned from work in preparation for the trip. And that was huge when he had a wife that wasn't working because I was being a mother. So I was not bringing in any income. And then for him to leave his work was huge. It's something that we obviously discussed, and I was happy, we felt that we were financially secure enough for him to do that. It's such a huge, huge dilemma. But when I did make that decision that, yeah, he's going to do this, I'm going to support him. And then I had to be so on board because I really felt that this was going to push him to his absolute limits and there was no room for negativity. So I was a little bit disturbed and distressed even by people that were giving these negative vibes. There's no room for that because there's no room for error on this trip.
By December 2006, Andrew was ready to make his attempt, and by this stage, filming for a documentary had already started. How was the kayak set up so that Andrew could film himself?
A deck-mounted camera, and he had his little handheld camera that he was doing video footage on. So there was a lot of footage that was taken in the preparation of the trip and then on test runs out in the ocean. But then he had all those cameras on board to film his expedition.
And for you and Finn on that day, you were there on the beach at Fortescue Bay to wave him off. What do you remember of that, farewell?
It was, well, I would have said it was the worst day of my life, but that was yet to come. It was so heart-wrenching. I was so devastated to see him off and, you know, I went into the water with him and I sort of probably went chest height to follow him out for as long as I could, holding his hand as he started to paddle off. And one of our friends was holding Finn. And then when I came back in, I ran up this track that goes up to the top of the cliff so that I could keep sight of him for as long as possible. And the friend that was holding Finn decided, well, they better come and follow me. And because I was on my own at that stage, when I lost sight of Andrew, I just sat down and just absolutely bawled. The tears were streaming, my whole body was shaking. I was so anxious and so hard to describe the feelings. And then Finn came running up the hill, so I had to quickly, put on a different mask and say, yeah, how exciting, Daddy's left, this is amazing. That was really hard.
Why did Andrew have to turn back on that first attempt?
I was very proud of him for making the decision to turn back. He'd only been out for about 24 hours and he was cold. And then he realised that it was getting water in the kayak, so it wasn't taking enough care to drain the water. And I don't know why the bilge pump wasn't picking up that the bit of residual water at the bottom. And he thought, well, you know, if I'm cold now, it's not really feasible for me to go on. And because he was, as I said, really meticulous in his planning, and he was, this might sound really weird, but he was actually risk averse. So he wasn't going to take that risk of continuing and suffering hypothermia and whatever else would happen. So he made the very prudent decision to turn around, which was quite hard work because then he was paddling into a headwind. And then he didn't, during that night, he didn't do his daily situation report. So that was a little stressful for the land crew. But then when he did make landfall, he rang me and said, I'm back on land. I didn't want to put my situation report in because you'd panic thinking what's going on because I'm going backwards. But I was so relieved that he came back and he made that decision to come back. And then I flew back down to Tasmania to pick him up. But as soon as I got there, by that stage he'd had a whole day to rest on the beach and reconsider things. And I guess I even knew from that phone call that that wasn't the end of it.
So Andrew set off again on January the 11th. Did that mean a second beach farewell for you and Finn?
We decided that the first beach farewell was traumatic for all concerned. So we made the prudent decision to say our farewells from our home in Glenbrook in the Blue Mountains. Finn was still asleep early morning when Andrew departed, but he went into his room and gave him a big cuddle and said, I love you, Googie, because we used to call him Finn Googie. He's very embarrassed about that now. It was only a few years ago that he said, how old do I have to be before you stop calling me Googie? I was devastated. But he said, he gave him a big kiss and cuddle. Finn was still asleep. Goodbye, Googie. Love you more than anything in the entire universe. And then he drove out and I was holding his hand out the window and I ran alongside him up the road for as long as I could. I'm going, love you more than anything in the universe. Love you more than anything in the universe. And then our hands parted and he continued to drive on. And then I just fell down in the driveway, burst into tears again and went back inside and thought, right, okay, I've got a job to do because I had to monitor the website. I had to put daily situation reports onto the website, writing little blogs, all very positive because that was my job description.
As he was making progress, Vicky, what kind of support was he having from the crew? He was out there alone, but what contact did he have with you guys on land?
Jonathan was sending him the daily weather forecast, and then Ant would then send back his situation report where he was and his observations of the weather conditions, which sometimes varied from Jonathan's forecast. But it was still a comfort for Andrew, even if the forecast wasn't exactly what was planned. It still gave him a bit of an idea of what was coming. Initially, though, he had some headwinds or just he didn't have the conditions that, well, I can't say that he was hoping for because you can't really hope for anything in the Tasman, especially below the 40th parallel. You're going to get horrendous conditions and really unpredictable conditions. But he didn't make all that much progress the first couple of days, and I think he was a little disheartened with that. But then he had some good following winds and he started to really build up the paddling days.
Did you get to speak with him on the phone at all?
I did. I spoke to him a couple of times. Once when we had a bit of an issue with his navigation system dying, but he had GPSs so he would then do manual navigating. I felt quite devastating to lose that, but he felt that it was still viable because he had several backup GPSs to be able to monitor his position. So I spoke to him about that. We had a conversation as he was approaching the coast. By that stage, he had a few pieces of equipment failing due to many capsizes and a couple of huge force 10 storms that he had suffered through.
How was his mood?
Initially, that earlier conversation, he exuded a positive air, but I could read in the background, I could read in the vibrations of his voice that he was pretty on edge, even though he was verbalising positivity. When we communicated as he was getting close to shore, his mood was positive. I felt that he was really positive, but he sounded really tired, and also he was talking to me through double dry bags, so it was quite muffled, the conversation, and brief because of the low battery situation. But he did sound very positive. I think he had a couple of big landmarks. You know, the halfway mark was huge. That was a huge achievement. And then as he drew closer to shore, it really looked like he's done and dusted, and we had so much support pouring in and so much positivity. Then, yeah, wow, this is amazing. This man is doing what we thought was not achievable.
So how far into Andrew's trip did you and Finn fly to New Zealand?
We flew over with about a week to go. So we went to Queenstown and set up base there. Hung around there for a few days, and we were waiting for communication as to when Andrew felt he would make landfall. But the night that we arrived in New Zealand, the weather conditions were horrendous. There was a massive force 10 storm, and his situation report didn't come through at the scheduled time. And knowing the horrific conditions, I was in a state of extreme distress. And then I put Finn to bed. He was playing up a little too, being in a different environment and eating food that he hadn't eaten before and having tantrums, and it was all really, really intense. But I put him to bed. He finally went down, and then I was so anxious just waiting up, and I was talking to Paul, have you heard anything? Talking to Mike, have you heard anything? Talking to Jonathan. I resorted to asking Jonathan what the weather was doing because I needed to know it was going to get better, and he wouldn't say that it was going to get better because he knew it wasn't and he didn't want to lie to me. But it was with such relief that the situation report came through around midnight or something. It was very late. Supposed to be 5:30 p.m. And I just collapsed with relief that he made it through that horrific storm. And then knowing that he'd made it through, he's only then a couple of days from shore. So then he spoke to me the next day, and that's when, you know, talking through muffled dry bags, he sounded very positive but exhausted, but said, yeah, we should then just relocate to Milford Sound. And I said, there's no communication down there, there's no mobile service, and I think that would be better to relocate to Tiana, which is only a short drive from Milford, and we'd wait there until he then let us know. And he said, well, if the batteries go flat, I'll be there 9 o'clock sharp on Sunday, which is pretty frightening from Andrew, knowing that he's never punctual. Every morning he would wait until he heard the train go past the back of our house, and then sprint from our house up to the train station, and sometimes miss the train, or sometimes the neighbour up the road would stop and pick him up and take him there. So he was not one for punctuality.
And it's hard to be punctual on the ocean.
Yes.
What happened on day 30, Vicky?
Andrew's father and sister, they flew over. So we were in Queenstown together, and we all went down to Tiana. We were sitting in a very noisy restaurant eating, and the mood was very positive because it was only going to be 2 days now before landfall, and everyone was so positive. I was still experiencing this underlying current of anxiety, knowing that Andrew was concerned about the approach to the coast because the topography is such that it makes really unpredictable ocean conditions. So he was worried about that from the very start, and Jonathan agreed that it was certainly something to worry about. It was the crux of the expedition, those last, you know, 70 k's to shore. So we weren't through it yet, but everyone's quite positive. But while we were eating, everyone's phone started going off. And then Paul rushed in and said, what's Andrew's call sign? And I said, "Why? What do you mean? What's going on?" And he said it was the RCC Rescue Coordination Centre saying they'd had a distress call. And they said it was Kayak One. I said, "Well, that's Andrew." And the RCC coordinator, he said that the transmission was very muffled and really hard to understand. We then went back to the hotel and he played me a snippet of the call that said, "This is Kayak One, this is Kayak One." And it sounded really muffled. And I wasn't sure whether there was Andrew, but it did sound like that same sort of muffled sound as when I spoke to him just previously through the drive bags, and thought, well, it could be him. Andrew's dad thought it wasn't him. He said he sounded drunk. And I said, well, I think that's because he's speaking through double drive bags, and plus he's just plain exhausted. I can't imagine he would have had much sleep in those 30 days. So we were still relatively positive. The RCC did send out a helicopter, but at that stage we just thought it was just a precautionary thing.
How long after that was his kayak found?
So that call all happened around 7:30-ish p.m. on the Friday the 9th of February 2007. We went down to Milford Sound the next day. One of the news crew offered to take me up in a helicopter, and I think Popper, that's Andrew's dad, came up in the helicopter too. And we thought we were really just going out there to find him and wave hello and think that how annoying is that for him? He'll be pretty peeved to think that there's a search out for him when he's happily paddling away. So we then came back. We didn't see him. And we went to bed that night, and Finn was just playing up again and was very, very excited because he was jumping on the bed going, "Oh, I'll see Daddy tomorrow. I'll see Daddy. I can't wait." And then the lights at the Milford Lodge, they're on a generator, so they turn the electricity off at 10. The generators go off at 10. But it was past 10, and I realised that. I thought, oh, well, how come the electricity hasn't gone off? And then some time later, everything's such a blur there. There was a knock on the door, and it was James Irv from the Tiana police with a lady that he introduced as being from victim support. And as soon as he said that, she came towards me wanting to hug me, and I pushed her away. What is she doing here? And that James delivered the news that Andrew's kayak was found, but he wasn't in it. And I said, "That is not him. That's another kayak. It's not his kayak. Go away. Go out and find him." And then the woman kept persisting that she had to give me a hug. I kept pushing away. And I said, "You go and find him. That's not him." And I said, "What colour is the kayak?" And he said, "Orange." Well, I'm sure there's another kayak out there. Couldn't believe that the kayak was found semi-submerged and my beautiful love of my life wasn't in it.
I'm so sorry, Vicky. Did you want them to keep searching, or did you know what that
meant? Yes, absolutely. I wanted them to keep searching. I said he must be out there, and he had an immersion suit, so he should have, if he had that on, which I was hoping he would, and if he had his PFD on, he would have still been afloat. The New Zealand authorities wanted to call the search off the next day, but the Australian government got involved and they persisted, and the search went on for another day. But then it was on Monday that they called the family together at 7:30 p.m. and announced that they'd called off the search and Andrew wasn't found. And that's when my world ended and I just collapsed.
What did you tell Finn had happened? What conversations did you have with your little boy?
Well, at that time, I was so engulfed in grief that I couldn't even, I was almost comatose. They had to get a doctor in and they put me to bed and he gave me a sleeping pill or injection or something. And it was so challenging to even get up and even communicate with anyone. And I was so lost that I don't even, it's just everything's a bit of a blur.
getting back with Finn to Australia, to, you know, your family home, it must have been absolutely just a hellish time to come back to. How soon after getting back, Vicky, did you want to see that footage that Andrew had been taken?
Yeah, well, on the trip? Very weirdly, while we're still in New Zealand, the ship that brought the kayak in, it then docked in Doubtful Sound. And so we helicoptered over to Doubtful Sound to see the kayak. And there was some of the footage from an SD card that the policeman gave to me. There was a lot of other footage that was just in a soggy dry bag. The water had penetrated because of the submersion of the kayak, so everything was soaking. So I did bring some of that footage home with me, and very bizarrely, and I can't even imagine how I had the strength to look at it, but I put on the computer and put the SD card in the computer, and then all these little video clips came to life on the screen. And it was so incredible because I was so mesmerised but so horrified and so deeply immersed in my grief but so absorbed in what I was seeing on the screen. It was so bizarre.
To see him giving reports as the...
Yeah, and for him to... saying, wow, this is such an adventure. It's so amazing. And that was really wonderful for me. You know, no, well, nothing was wonderful at the time, but it gave me a very brief respite from my grief to know that Andrew experienced such profound, amazing things out there that few humans ever get to experience. And so I was so grateful for that. But then in the next footage, he'll be, you know, you could barely even see his face. He's got the camera looking into his face and he's making a video diary and he looks so drawn and so exhausted and he's saying, I'm not even halfway there yet and I don't even know whether this is achievable. I think I've bitten off more than I can chew. I just want to be home with my wife and my baby. And that was so devastating to hear that. It's... such raw emotion, I can't even, there are no words for what happened that day when I was looking at that footage and even for what happened beyond.
And I think about you there, you know, looking after a three-year-old, it's so all-consuming. They don't understand that you're in grief. They don't pull back in their needs in any way. You were having to fully mother and then suddenly solo mother this little person. How did you try to take care of all the feelings that were there in you at the same time as looking after little Finn?
It was extremely challenging. Jen and Ben, who was another guy that initially started the concept of the documentary, he came and picked me up one day and said, I'm taking you to see this man, Bernie Brown, this big bear of a man with a big beard and looked very scary, but he was so beautiful and gentle and humble and incredible. He was a counsellor. So I started counselling. He was a lifesaver actually because all the work I did with him was at times excruciating, but ultimately it was essential that I went through that trauma counselling where we relived the experience. And I'm eternally grateful for Jen Peedham. She came with me and sat with me through all those sessions as we relived that time in New Zealand. So that really helped. And the reason that I went to the counselling, firstly, I wasn't coping at all and I had a little baby. Well, he was then turned 4 a few months after Andrew's. After what happened, and I really wasn't coping and I wasn't able to cope with him, and I thought, this is not a viable situation, and Andrew would be so disappointed in me if I cannot look after our baby and if I cannot continue to just get on with life and flourish. And I thought, how disappointed would he be So I have to do everything within my power to work my way through this. And I remember one of my friends from yoga, she had lost her husband many years ago, and she said that she didn't allow the grieving process to occur. She went straight back to work and she sort of put it behind her and put it in a closet. And then 10 years later, she had a major breakdown. So that was really, really supportive advice for me. It's just what I needed to hear, because I thought, I cannot let that happen. So I have to, as hard as it is, work my way through all the processes that are necessary to get me to become a functioning human being again.
What role did karate come to play for you and Finn in that?
Well, karate was such a huge... it was another lifesaver. I had several lifesavers. The process of grief, it's sort of, it goes in layers, and it is really never ending, but you learn to adapt and live with it. But there are many processes and emotions that you experience. Anger is one of those emotions. Anger is a very interesting thing, because I was never angry with Andrew, and I never wanted to be angry with Andrew, because how can you be angry with somebody that is so passionate about life and so incredibly courageous and inspirational? And you can't be angry with that. But I was angry with the situation. And Bernie said, you know, it's pretty helpful to punch a pillow. And so I started punching a pillow and screaming into a pillow at times. And then Finn expressed a desire to do karate. So, okay, so there was a karate school down the hill, and we went along to that. And then the people that we met there were all so wonderfully supportive, and the whole karate community was really supportive. So it was a really great outlet, a physical outlet for us to have permission to punch people. So punching people was really helpful. And then so we went on to get our black belts, which was amazing, and I felt that that was a great personal achievement to do that.
Were you conscious of trying to raise him with that sort of adventurous spirit that Andrew had?
Absolutely. He was physically had a lot of his father's features, so that was at times beautiful, but at times really bittersweet to look into that beautiful face and see his father. But he also has grown up into the most beautiful young man, and he has Andrew's gentle nature and his compassion, but he certainly has his spark for adventure. So I instilled that, or sort of lit that spark, by taking him on as many of adventures that I could. We'd do a lot of bushwalking and a little bit of paddling. And I took him on a few overseas trips. We went to South America and we did the Machu Picchu. I took him to India with me. We did an amazing trek in Swiss Alps. That was a wonderful trip.
And for you, Vicky, what role has yoga played over the last nearly two decades?
Well, it was certainly my biggest lifesaver. When I came back and felt that I was able to get back out into the public realm, which did take some months for me to even feel confident to go to the shops. But then when I felt brave enough to go back to yoga class, I really identified that as being part of my healing process. But it was also quite challenging, because yoga does bring up a lot of emotions, and I would end up in tears at the end of nearly every class. And after this went on for a few weeks, maybe a month or something, my beautiful teacher Ben at the time said, I'm sorry, but I think you better not come to classes anymore. That was so devastating for me. But then in the next breath he said, but you can come and practice with me and we'll just do practice together. We did a lot of, really strong yoga practice then, and that really took me out of my mind and brought me into my body, and then eventually allowed my mind and body to coordinate in a manner that gave me a glimpse at times of peace. And then Ben said one day, I think you should become a teacher. And then that sparked that idea, well, if yoga has been so beneficial for me, I really feel that it is my duty, my responsibility to pass that on to others. And so then I started the excruciating journey of Iyengar yoga teacher training. And I always use Andrew as my inspiration for everything. If Andrew could do that, surely I can do this. So I just keep going. I keep working at it. And eventually I became a qualified teacher. And it has become my life and my great passion and, yes, my saviour.
It's nearly 20 years since you lost Andrew. I say lost, but it sounds like he's still so close to you.
He is so much. This may sound weird, but I talk to him every night. I talk to him sometimes during the day. I feel that I communicate with him. When Finn and I go out to our special spot in the Walgan Valley, which we've decided to be our little commemorative place just because Andrew's body was never found and it's not really feasible for us to go out into the Tasman Sea every year. We did go for the 10th anniversary. That was a really very life-affirming experience for us both. But we go out to the Walgan Valley and we climb up to the top of the cliffs and to this very special place where Andrew and I went for our first date. And we sit there and we commemorate my beautiful husband, Finn's beautiful father. We post a little red envelope that's got photos and little stories of what we've been up to in the last, well, I say 6 months because we go there for Andrew's birthday in August as well. And we mail the photos with all our little stories on them down through this little fissure in the rock. And so there's 19 years worth of envelopes down there and we cover them so no one knows they're there. So we sit there on the rock and we read together. We look at the photos, we flip them over and read the little stories we've written. And then we hold our hands out with our palms facing up and close our eyes and say, hold our hands. Hold our hands, Aunt. Hold our hands, Dada. We love you. And we can feel this palpable energy. I can feel him now. I've got my hands out. My palms are facing up. I can feel a tingling in my palms. I can feel his energy. I can feel his warmth. I can feel his compassion and his never-ending love. And that sustains me.
Vicky, it's been just extraordinary to meet you. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
It's been a great pleasure for me too, Sarah.
Vicky McCauley was my guest on Conversations today. This story was produced by Jen Leake and recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.